Hello, and welcome to The Rundown, a podcast from Politics Home. I'm your host, Alan Tolhurst, and this week we're taking another look at candidate selection, the somewhat secretive elections that will really decide what the next parliament will look like, as all parties ramp up their processes to choose people to stand in seats up and down the country as we get closer to a general election. To discuss how people become parliamentary candidates, I'm delighted to say I have three of those vying to become MPs this year, as well as the man who is doing more than anyone to shed light on these selections. With me is Michael Crick, veteran political correspondent who runs the Tomorrow's MPs account on Twitter, as well as Kobe Patterson-Vallis, Tory candidate in Brighton, Kempton and Peacetown, and a pair of Liberal Democrat candidates, Josh Pabarinde, who is standing in Eastbourne, and Roz Savage, who is standing in South Cotswolds. So I'm going to start with you, Michael. Just kind of talk us through what are the kind of candidate selection processes, just briefly, and then also what your account tries to do, the Tomorrow MP's account on Twitter or X, as we should call it now.
Well, the candidate processes are actually really quite similar in that shortlist is drawn up. In the case of Labour and the Conservatives, it's a shortlist drawn up between with the National Party and the regional and the locals working together, and then the members get to choose from that shortlist. And in the Conservative Party, they still have the old-fashioned selection meeting, and you can't have a vote in the process unless you go to the meeting and listen to the candidates and listen to the questions and answers. In the other parties, they've developed this so that they've got postal voting, and in Labour do a lot of online voting, and indeed, in the selection that's happening right now, the really contentious one in Islington North to replace Jeremy Corbyn, it all seems to be going online and by post. There are no meetings. And indeed, you might wonder why that is. I suspect it's because they want to have a meeting with a huge demonstration outside of Corbyn supporters saying that the whole thing was unfair on him. In the different parties have different ways of assessing their candidates. I mean, in the Conservative Party, for instance, you've got to get on the candidate's list, which can be quite a long, drawn-out process. On the other hand, if a party really likes you, the central party really likes you, you can get on the candidate's list in a matter of hours. We've seen that with some of the recent by-elections. But the real tension is between the centre and the local. I mean, the centre wants to put in people who are close to the leadership, potential ministers, cabinet ministers, and you can perfectly well understand that. You need, you know, you're not just electing tomorrow's MPs. A lot of these people will be ministers, probably more than half at one point or another. And the locals who say, no, we want a good MP for Tolpuddle or wherever. And many of them will tell you, we're not interested in our MP becoming a minister. That trend, the emphasis on the candidate being local, has got stronger and stronger and stronger at recent elections, to the extent now that it's almost impossible for the Labour Party, for a winnable seat, to get selected without strong local credentials.
It's kind of a prerequisite, isn't it? Yeah.
Still important in the Conservatives as well, and the Lib Dems, who really started all this, I think, about 40 or 50 years ago. So, and that means also a lot of the candidates now are either councillors or former councillors, about two-thirds of them. So the nature of the kind of people who are getting to Parliament is changing, and you no longer have what are disparagingly called, you know, carpet baggers or people are being parachuted in. There's a lot less of that now, although we will see towards the end of the year, I'm sure.
Yeah, we'll come on to some of those kind of trends, but let's talk to some of those candidates. So you and I have talked about the Tory selections and Labour selections. We've got two Lib Dems. I'm glad we've got two Liberal Democrat candidates. So I want to talk about their kind of process. So I'll start with you, Josh. Your kind of backstory, how did you get into politics, and then how did you get selected down in Eastbourne?
Yeah, so my story is I'm an Eastbourne boy, born and bred, so I took...
See, good local connections straight away. It's first thing there.
Tick the local box that Michael referred to. And I spent my career supporting kids out of crime and gangs and into employment. I set up a social enterprise that I ran for a number of years doing that. That was based in London. And for me, I loved that work. It was difficult. I loved the work. But fundamentally, I found that I was, you know, coming up with a very niche solution to actually what were a set of systemic problems that can be addressed in great part by politicians, and found myself at ministerial roundtables and contributing to consultations and all that. And I thought I would much rather be on the other side of the table working from the inside. And so that kind of combined with my love, some say my obsession for my town. I have Eastbourne Pier tattoo on my arm, literally. and my belief in place-based change and the role of a local MP as a catalyst for that kind of brings together the local and the systemic for me.
Yeah. So what point then did you think that, okay, I need to shift actually to becoming rather involved in politics, actually a parlementarian, and kind of how did that go over? Had you been a member of the party before, or did it all kind of happen quite quickly?
Yeah, I've been a member of the party since I was 16.
One of those, are you? Okay, fine. Yeah.
Well, I'm not really one of those. I joined by accident.
Classic Lindem answer.
I joined by accident. I joined because I wanted the free beer mat that was being given away at the time, except it wasn't free. You had to pay to join the party. So a friend paid for me to join the party. I then got to read up more on what all of the parties were offering, and the Liberal Democrats is where my values were and are. So I was involved in Liberal Democrat activism, you know, started with delivering leaflets, knocking on doors. We won the seat off the Conservatives in that election in 2010. And then I got to see what our MP, Liberal Democrat MP, got up to on a local level, really impressed by that. And it became clear it was, you know, the power of politics for me. And then after the 2019 general election, when that MP, Stephen Lloyds is his name, fantastic guy, lost his seat, it was clear he wasn't going to be standing again, that a selection was going to be taking place. And so I'd spoken to kind of mentors and other people in the party around what the selection process looks like. You know, it involves putting your name forward. Any person who is a member can put themselves forward. Any member can vote. Indeed, any member can vote on party policy as well. Yeah, as Michael said, there was a committee that put together a shortlist, and then it was for the several hundred members in Eastbourne to decide. So I campaigned away. I knew a lot of them anyway. I had grown up with the party. You know, I joined it when I was 16. I got selected when I was 28. So a lot of them were like family, to be honest, and had got the chance to know me and my values and what I was about over a period of time.
Beer mats cost you quite a lot over the years, I suppose, then, hasn't it?
It has.
Roz, then you've obviously got quite a different background. I think you're the first holder of several Guinness World Records to be on the podcast, unless any politician's been hiding those under their bushel. But so how did you end up moving from, you know, rowing across the oceans to becoming a Lib Dem candidate? And if I may be so bold, why on earth do you want to join Parliament, having done such amazing things all around the world? Why do you want to come to SW1?
It is a very good question. But it might sound like a bit of a random career change, but there is actually a golden thread running through it. Yeah, my background was, I was in business for 11 years, and then I had a sort of environmental awakening. And the reason that I did all that slogging alone across very large oceans was because I really wanted to raise awareness of the ecological crisis, but I needed a way to get people's attention, and doing something quite as unpleasant and masochistic as that seemed like a good way to achieve that goal. So I was then able to use my blogs and my books and giving talks to get my environmental message across. So that's what I spent 7 years rowing across oceans and continued to be an environmental campaigner after that. And I think what really triggered this bout of madness that now has me standing for Parliament, although it seemed to be sort of a recurring pattern here. I'd done a doctorate in systems change, really, looking back over my years as an environmental campaigner and asking myself the question, why have all of these campaigners, why have we not been able to achieve more positive, intentional change? And so it ended up really being an analysis of a systems approach, going through politics and economics and even psychology and neuroscience. And so having then written the book based on my dissertation, I was thinking, I feel like I've learned a lot about what's wrong in the world, and I've got a positive vision of how things could be better if we really work together and collaborate and get creative about this, how can I now put this into action? And it was actually on the day of the Queen's funeral that this idea landed to stand for Parliament. I was reflecting on her 70 years of dedicated public service. And I thought, well, if she could do 70 years, then. And so that was September 2023. So it's been a rapid journey through the candidate approval process, which is quite rigorous, and then going through selection, which I actually went through twice, once under the old constituency boundaries, and then again immediately after.
Yeah, of course, because South Cotswolds, where you're going to be standing, is a new constituency on different boundaries, isn't it? Okay.
It very much is, yes. Very big change in ways that are very beneficial for the Lib Dems, so I'm very grateful.
glad that you're able to accept that. That's good. Right, well, Kobe, moving on to you then. Obviously, you actually have got a bit of a different background. You had worked in the civil service. You've worked in party politics before that and worked for MPs. So what made you kind of take that step from, you know, working within politics, but actually wanting to stand yourself then?
So, yeah, it's really interesting just listening to everybody else's journeys. And I think the really common theme here is public service. So civil service is a very strange route into politics, but I loved my time in the civil service. And I do think, actually, unlike most politicians, I'm going to say something that is really important, and that is that they are the backbone of our democracy. You know, they make sure that the process is followed. They make sure that there's transparency, and it's a really, they're not looking for all the credit, and they do it all. You know, I think they're fabulous. There's always space for improvement and reform, but I think they're absolutely brilliant. And for me, it was about, they are the implementers, and I was working on lots of things that enriched lives, technology, sport, cultural things. And then I went to the Home Office, and actually reflecting on what Josh just said, worked on actually some of the much harder, grittier issues facing us, and realised that the things that enrich lives are actually often the cure to a lot of the things where people are struggling. And I really wanted to be part of that decision-making process. I think it's similar to what's already been said. And I really wanted to be part of the conversation rather than just kind of doing the best after the decision's been made to try and get it implemented.
Yeah, interesting. So as Michael said, obviously, with Conservatives, there are things like the A list and the B list. Of, what was the kind of process for you to go through? Did you end up on the A list, or was it an open selection for, it's another new constituency down in Brighton, isn't it? It's an amalgamation of two of the Brighton constituencies.
No, Brighton, Kempton, Peacehaven is already.
Is it still exactly the same, is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's not actually hugely affected by the boundary changes. So there isn't so much an A list and a B list. I think that has been the case in the past. That isn't how it works now. So much like other parties, you sort of apply to the national list, and that's a very rigorous process. It's a sort of skills-based competency process where you have lots of sort of questions and different stages really to test if you are a good candidate for the Nolan principles of public life. That's really what it's looking at. And then once you're on the national list, there are definitely different levels of pass, and then you can apply to different seats based on that level of pass. So yeah, I got a good pass, but I only wanted to apply for seats. And I see, I was reflecting on your point about being local. And I think one really important point that was made to me by one of the selectorate, if you will, one of the local teams, was actually you can, it's really important to be local, but you can get local. And I thought that was quite an interesting point. And it's interesting because it comes up on the doorstep. So I have lived in Sussex for a long time, but I don't live within boundaries of my potential constituency. And it's interesting because I think what I think is really important is that you are willing to get local. So I spend more of my time in Brighton, to be honest, than I do at home. And which is how it should be. And if elected, then absolutely MPs, to my mind, should be living and breathing within their areas. That's something I feel really strongly about. Obviously, there's a huge demand for them to be in Westminster. And I think it's really important that they are the local voice on national issues. I think having a background as a councillor can make you a fantastic MP, but it's really important they're not just super councillors. To your point, we need to have a cabinet that can face some of the most difficult issues in the world. When I think about my experience in the Home Office and national security, you know, these are big, scary issues that need policy, creative, actually, as well says, very creative policy solutions, and people who want to sit on a legislation committee and dig through hours and hours of things like that. So I think that's really important. But yeah, and then you apply locally. So I applied to the city of Britain, Kemp Town and Peacehaven, and the local party selected me. So I only wanted to apply for seats that were in Sussex and Surrey because of my Get Local point. I didn't want to move really far away from where my family is, you know, where I've got great support structures. And, you know, it is very exposing being a member of parliament. I've seen that firsthand from my previous roles. And I think it's really important to have a good support structure in place.
Yeah, absolutely. So Michael, then obviously you've got three candidates here with very different backgrounds. You talked about actually there's a bit of a homogenousness about some of the candidates that have been selected. Actually, just talk us through before we get to that. How far through selections are we? How many of the Tories and Labour done?
Well, all the parties have done most of the ones that are winnable. I mean, I think Labour have got about 120 to go, the Conservatives about 180, but those figures may be slightly lower because there may be ones I haven't heard about. But in terms of the ones they can win, the figures are much lower, and the Lib Dems too, which is sort of understandable where we are right now within the Parliament. By the way, Josh didn't mention that he actually standing against his old teacher. Aren't you just Caroline Ansell, the sitting MP?
That's right. She was once my supply teacher for 1 hour of RE when I was in year 11, and she taught me everything I know.
That's so good.
The people who get chosen are very middle class. I mean, more middle class, I think, than ever. You know, even Labour, which claim, you know, that there's only about a dozen people in the Labour side that you can say are genuinely working, you know, currently do working class jobs. And that's a trend that's been going on for decades now. And, you know, the unions these days have very little role in the process. And there's not many that you can say, well, the unions got that one.
Yeah. And you and I spoke last year, and I think there was only about two candidates you would say maybe were on the left of the party. Has there been any more candidates on the left selected?
About five, I reckon, including actually Chris Webb. Who just won the by-election in Blackpool South. And indeed Luke Akehurst, who is a member of the Labour National Executive and very much one of the fixers behind the scene. A lot of fixing goes on in the Labour Party and in the Conservative Party, but most in the Labour Party. And certainly Luke's a fixer. And I mean, even he admitted at an event I did with him at the Labour conference last year that their candidates were very samey. You know, there's lots of people who are in communications or public affairs, whatever that means, or, you know, who are believing or work for think tanks to do with health or international development or refugees, all the sort of things that look attractive. The Conservative list, actually, I think, has got a bit more variety about it. There's quite a lot of people like Roz with a sort of sporting, well, about a dozen people with about a sort of sporting backgrounds. And you've got probably more people with military backgrounds, I think, than in the past, especially in Labour. And they've gone out of their way, I think, to get people with military background.
Kobe, do you want to come in on that? Kobe, you work in public affairs, don't you? So you're going to defend those who work in public affairs.
I didn't want to defend. I just wanted to inform Michael. It's very rare I get the opportunity to inform Michael. But I think one thing I would say is I think it's really important to have politicians from all backgrounds. So absolutely, we need teachers. We need people that have done all sorts of different things. But we also need politicians to understand how Parliament works. And I think that is a really important role. I mean, I work in public affairs. I work at a public affairs agency and I head up our sort of tech, media, telecoms and sometimes financial services work. And it's the thing I always say is that government wants to talk to its stakeholders. It's not a dark art, but that's really difficult sometimes. And people really struggle to speak the language of politicians. And what I think is really important is that they are able to do that, and that's what the role of public affairs does, right? You know, it allows businesses and government and charities and government. You know, we do a lot of work with charities to be able to all speak the same language and act as a bit of a translator. And that is across all political parties. You know, if you want to speak to Keir Starmer at the moment, you need to be talking about how you as a business or as an organization can help with the missions led approach he's talking about. You know, for the Conservative Party, for years, they've been desperately trying to ensure that against some of these most difficult policy issues, we need businesses to help really find a way to be helping tackle them.
Lobbyist is what a lot of public affairs is all about. And I think that another point that's worth making is that one of the reasons why the lists are so middle class is it's increasingly expensive for candidates to get selected. You have to travel there a lot, spend a lot of time there. It's expensive in terms of money and in time. Only people from certain backgrounds can take the time off to put in the work locally. And indeed, increasingly, candidates are paying, you know, quite large sums of money. I mean, not all of you, I know, and probably not none of the people here, but there are agencies that offer to try and help you. And they can charge thousands and thousands of pounds. I mean, there's one called College Green, for instance, which, you know, several candidates of clients of theirs. There's one, a Labour one up in Warrington called We Are Civitas. And also the life of a candidate, you know, the demands on you. And you know, the parties say, right, well, you've got to make all these contacts and you've got to spend all these days. And in the Labour Party, you've got to sign a contract committing, if you're for a hopeless seat, committing to go and fight a specified promising seat. And I think increasingly candidates are sort of treated as cheap labour.
Right, well, Roz, I'll bring you in on that then. How's life been as a candidate? And as Michael says, it's quite difficult to put in not just the, you know, to put in the time and the effort to be able to get to that selection point. Were you aware of that when you first sort of stuck your hand up? Like you say, when you watched the Queen's Funeral, you thought, right, I want to go for this. Did you know at that point what it was going to entail?
I think I sometimes say there's a lot to be said for having enough naive optimism to get yourself into something and then stubborn pride to get yourself back out.
Yeah, I'm seeing lots of smiles and nods from the other candidates here on that one, yeah.
I think Michael makes a very fair point. I think it is a deeply flawed system that does result in a narrow pool of talent being actually able to stand for Parliament. I'm incredibly lucky in that my day job as a keynote speaker at conferences, talking about my ocean rowing adventures and what I've learned about courage, resilience, determination, purpose, all of that kind of thing, takes up very little of my time. I look at some of my colleagues, especially the ones with teenagers, with aging parents, with aging in-laws, and who maybe haven't been able to completely give up their job, they've gone part-time. The pressures on their time are unbelievable. And of course, it's unpaid.
Yeah. And especially in a battleground seat where you've got to go out and do lots of campaigning, as a lot of the Lib Dem target seats are, you know, you've got to campaign really hard to win those seats, right?
Indeed. It's one of the biggest jobs of my life. And I don't know when the deadline is, because we don't know when the general election's going to be. And it is really all-consuming. And like I say, I'm fortunate. That's the way that I like to do things, is all in anyway, literally immersive. But it really does take a toll. And I think that some reform of that system to make it easier for candidates to stand while meeting financial and family obligations would mean that we can draw on a bigger and more diverse pool of talent, which we really need if we're going to get out of that groupthink at the top.
Yeah. Josh, has that been your experience as well since you stood a couple of years ago?
Absolutely. I mean, it's tricky. As a candidate, so you know, I used to be an entrepreneur, and the line between life and work was very blurred. And as a candidate, it's that times a million, not least because you don't see the, you know, fundamental kind of outcome of all your work until election day. And, you know, there have been cases where folks have lost by 1-2 votes, etc. And you don't want to be that person. And so you want to pull out all the stops. I certainly do. I'm sure all of us on this podcast do. So I went part-time in my day job when I first got selected as a candidate. And then I quit my day job just over a year ago so that I could throw absolutely everything at it. Now, I don't have bank of mum and dad or anybody else. I'm a working class boy from an estate that I love. but that isn't known for its wealth in Eastbourne. In fact, we have the busiest food bank in the UK in Eastbourne that's headquartered in my patch. And so it was tricky to figure out how it might be able to work. Nowhere near as tricky, of course, as everyone who's suffering with this cost of living emergency and struggling more than ever. So this isn't the kind of boo-hoo, how terrible it is to be a candidate. We're all choosing to do this. And it is a real privilege. But I think in order to diversify the kind of folks who are putting themselves forward, who are able to put themselves forward, who are able to serve as candidates indefinitely, you know, until the Prime Minister has the cojones to call this election, it requires a lot of, you know, holding uncertainty, which is super tough financially. Like, I remember when, you know, we were expecting possibly a May the 2nd election earlier this year. And at that point, it was the case that, okay, well, you know, it's a chance for the country to refresh. And then when it wasn't on the 2nd of May, it's like, oh my goodness. Not only has the country got to go through another 6 months of this, but my goodness, how am I going to afford to make it for, you know, another 6 months potentially? Or maybe even longer to January. So something that I've done, I mentioned this to Michael a couple of years ago, is I've got, you know, a bunch of friends, collaborators, ex-colleagues who aren't necessarily Lib Dems, but who want to see good people in Parliament, who've got to see some of my work in action, and from whom I crowdfunded a stipend to help cover some of my living costs. And I think what was really powerful about that is that a lot of those folks said, you know what, we'd love to do this again for other people, for other candidates of all parties to help great people come through. And so something that I'm committed to doing, whatever the result of the election, is finding a way to formalise that kind of vehicle for other people to benefit from. I think our democracy fails to formally recognise the important role that candidates play in democratic life. And I think that there is a need for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. We need people to challenge those, who even those incumbents, you know, challenge them. Kobe, essentially, I don't know if you've seen, obviously, within the Conservative Party, they've tried some things. Obviously, there's been things like Women to Win, trying to get more women into the party. Obviously, the Labour tried with all women shortlists. I think the Conservatives even tried open primaries in 2010, which had some good candidates to begin with, but not all of them have necessarily lasted as Conservatives since then. I just wondered, you've obviously seen it from both sides. You've worked for the party and in the civil service and now standing as an MP. Do you think there are improvements that can be made, you know, with the Conservative selections and others in terms of trying to get a better cohort of people trying to stand?
So I think, I mean, you mentioned Women to Win, which was what I was going to mention. Baroness Jenkins does a fantastic job of leading Women to Win. And I think what's really important, and certainly within the Conservative Party, is not to have a women shortlist, because actually you're not encouraging just women to be the best candidates. You're just encouraging women candidates. And I think we have to be really careful with that. But what is brilliant about Women to Win is they do so, so much, lots of training sessions. And one thing I really want to say, and I'm sure Ros will agree with me, is that if you are a woman and you feel like you already have lots of different hats on, but you're even vaguely interested in applying, please do. There are actually quite a few organisations that work on this. So 50-50 Parliament is looking to try and get 50-50 Parliament, as it says on the tin. Fantastic what they do. There's an organisation called Elect Her, which is looking at for women from disadvantaged, women from disadvantaged or backgrounds or feel like they can't afford to stand. They give grants, fantastic, to help you travel around. So please look at them. And even better, if you want to be a Conservative MP, then please reach out to Women to Win and the Conservative Women's Organisation, because they do lots with potential candidates and there's so much going on with mentoring, etc. So please do that, because we know that women definitely feel less confident coming forward for lots of the caring responsibilities or that have been referred to. I think as a party, we actually do quite well against what perception is. Like Gillian Keegan as Education Secretary, you know, she was an apprentice. She's done so much for women in the party from backgrounds, like non-traditional backgrounds, to become a Conservative Cabinet Minister, and she does a fantastic job. I was at something yesterday where Siobhan Bailey was talking about being a kid with on free school meals at 15, and now she's a Member of Parliament, and she's fantastic.
Yeah. Some great stories. I think overall, unfortunately, the Conservatives are still about 30% still, I think, of MPs. And I think the candidates is better, but I'm sure Michael can correct me. I think actually, unfortunately, some of the female candidates are in the less winnable seats, and that there's often the sort of selected men get put in the seats where it's likely for them to hold on to seats. So I wonder if perhaps actually it's that broader issue he's looking at as well.
So I think what's really important is that women apply. We're still not the bit as many on the candidates list. So if women aren't on the candidates list and then they don't apply, you're not going to get a woman selected. And I know that Women to Win do so much to encourage people to feel confident to apply. And I think that even once you're on the list, you know, it's quite a time consuming process. And to all of the pressures everyone else has just talked about, you know, I still do my full-time job, so I can afford to be everywhere I need to be as well. But it is absolutely exhausting, whilst a complete privilege. So I think it's a bit of a chicken and egg, right? You need to encourage women to and people from all backgrounds to have the support, to do the mentoring or to have the mentoring available to apply. And then once they apply, we'll see more of them on the list. I think the problem is, I mean, I fell into the civil service by accident. I was the first member of my family to go to university. The thing I would really stress is, I mean, I had wonderful mentors like Tracy Crouch. Working for her was brilliant because she was really normal. But actually, if we don't find ways to make people aware that this is even an option for them, unless they have a huge campaigning background, then they're not going to suddenly come to the realization that they might be a member of parliament. So we need to get into schools, we need to get into universities or wherever, and into communities, and we need to really encourage people to be involved in public life.
And could I come in on the other backgrounds thing as well? I mean, within the Liberal Democrats, we've got great organisations like Lib Dem Women, the Campaign for Gender Balance, that provide a lot of mentoring and support for women who want to stand. And we also have the Racial Diversity Campaign, that supports ethnic minorities to stand. And beyond the political party, you've got organisations like Operation Black Vote, some of whom's programmes I've benefited from, to help ethnic minorities stand.
Yeah, because unfortunately, I think it was after the 2015 or 2017 election, I think every single Lib Dem MP was a white man, I think, after one election. It was, and then you've obviously worked very hard to improve that diversity since then, right?
There's definitely some work to do, lots of work done, more work to do. But for example, the Liberal Democrats have never had an MP of Black heritage elected as a Liberal Democrat. In fact, Eastbourne is our best shot next time. But we definitely need to do more to support folks from all backgrounds to be able to put themselves forward for selection, have the confidence, and then also to support them with the means and inspiration and guidance and mentoring to stand and, you know, to be great kick-ass candidates who can win.
Just wanted to say that of our 15 Lib Dem MPs, two-thirds are women. So as Josh said, we have more work to do on that. But on the gender balance, we are doing well, and all tribute to the fabulous women at the campaign there.
Yeah, and a deputy leader now as well as a female and stuff. It has definitely changed. I mean, it was partly a quirk of the fact that the Lib Dems went down to very few seats, but it was sort of striking for a while, clearly, that hadn't happened. So, Michael, just a last word to you then before we wrap up then. What have you made overall of who we've seen selected, and what do you think that means for what the next parliament's going to look like? If there is a Labour victory, as we suspect, what's the next parliament going to look like in terms of those backgrounds and experiences? I often bemoan the lack of sort of mavericks in parliament. Are there going to be even fewer mavericks next time, or how's it going to look? Is it a bit more professional next time?
There are not many obvious mavericks, but people tend to may just hide their characters a bit when they try and become candidates. I mean, you know, the number of women will go up. The number of people from ethnic minorities will go up. The Conservatives are lagging behind on that, as we've discussed. They're about 30%. Labour are nearly 50% on their new candidates. And of course, now they've got more than 50%, which means that they're not allowed to do all women shortlists anymore. One really interesting trend is the number of gay and lesbian and bisexual MPs, I think, could be above 100 after the election, which is sort of way above the national figures. And actually, that's caused some resentment amongst Labour women, because they say, well, first of all, that the figures are too high. And they say, well, it's easier for young gay people because they tend not to have families. And the real impediment, they argue, is that if you have a family, that is, an, you know, does make it really difficult to get chosen. And I was interested in what Kobe said about buying a house in the constituency. That's all right, I think, if you're in Brighton, because you can commute to London. But if what is a woman with kids, maybe, you know, primary school kids or even teenage kids, perhaps with certain mental problems, what do they do if they're the MP for, you know, Teesside or whatever? Do they have two houses? Where does the family live? Does it live in the constituency so they don't see them half the week, or do they live in London? That is, I think, a big impediment.
Yeah, it's never something that's never really been resolved, has it? I don't think. It's always been an issue for where people live, but it's never really been resolved, I don't think. And people have been more conscious of that, I think, as Parliament becomes younger, becomes more family friendly, essentially. It's become, people think about it more, I suppose.
But the other thing is, which we haven't really discussed at all, is politics. in that, if anything, I think the two big parties are moving to the centre. Certainly the Labour Party. I mean, you know, the left has been purged in a quite authoritarian way, in my view, and really some outrageous purging's gone on there on a scale that Labour's always done a bit of it, but not to the extent of the Starmer regime. So it's going to be much more loyal Labour Party, at least to start with, a much more right-wing Labour Party. And if anything, I think you may see the same, a little bit of the same trend, funnily enough, in the Conservatives, in that most of those people who came in 2019 for the so-called Red Wall, big supporters of Boris Johnson, big supporters of Brexit, nearly all of them, or possibly all of them, are going to lose their seats. And actually, if you look at the candidates who've been chosen this time, they're not all very right-wing. It's often difficult to tell what their politics are, but there's quite a few other candidates who are supporters of Remain, some still are. So you could even see the Conservatives move slightly towards the centre as well, which is ironic, really, given that our politics is, well, certainly the politics of most of the West seems to be polarising. But as I say, I think candidates quite often hide what their politics are at this stage, and it only becomes apparent once they're elected what they really believe in. I can't say I blame them, really.
Yeah, no. Well, the less of that said, the better. Let's just quickly then, we're at least each of the three of you, Kobe, Roz, then Josh, just kind of a last word. What would you kind of say to anyone who's thinking about standing? Obviously, there are still selections going, might stand in the future. Just quickly, each of you, what would you kind of, your advice to be if someone's thinking about it?
I think we need credible candidates for every party and every seat. And it's really important that if you are even contemplating applying to the list for your party, please do it.
Where there's a will, there is a way. And I found that people who are already in Parliament have been generous in their mentorship, that there is support available. Just ask for advice. Just contact an MP through their website or whatever. I think that there is a growing understanding that we do need a lot more diversity of thought, not just diversity of colour or gender in the House of Commons.
Absolutely. And Josh?
Just do it with me would be my advice. When I was running my business or starting up, I thought, goodness, I've never done this before. What on earth can prepare me to do this? I'm not sure I'm ready. And I found that the best thing that could prepare me for running a business was to run a business and learn along the way. Exactly the same when it comes to candidacy. Do it. There'll be a bunch of times where you don't quite know what to do next, how you're meant to do it. But as the others have said, there are mentors out there, whether individuals, whether organisations. You learn as you go. It's an exhilarating ride. It's a massive honour. And even more so if we get over the line at the next election.
Right, that's all we've got time for this week, but you can read all the latest on the big stories from Westminster at politicshome.com and keep right up to date by subscribing to our 7-day newsletters by hitting the link on our homepage. Thanks to our brilliant guests, Michael Crick, Roz Savage, Kobe Patterson-Vallis and Josh Babarinde. Thanks to you all for listening. Please subscribe wherever you podcast and leave us a nice review. And if you want to get in touch, then reach out to us on Twitter at politicshome, or you can email us via news@politicshome.com. But for now, I've been Alan Tolhurst, and this has been The Rundown.